Well, one of the ways that God deals with us is through his word. And so it's a joy to open it together and to look at this chapter, 1 Samuel chapter 25, giving us the title, How to Spot a Fool and How to Be Wise. How to Spot a Fool and How to Be Wise. 1 Samuel 25, look how the chapter begins. It begins with these words, Then Samuel died. Although we're looking at the life of David, this book and the next one, of course, are named after Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel. He's been a major figure in the life of Israel. He's, of course, been a prophet, but he has also been the last of the judges. Before a king was appointed, Israel was ruled by judges, and Samuel was the last of them. This book begins with his birth. And really, it shows how Samuel is the link between these two eras, if you like, the period of the judges and then the period of the kings. He's the last judge, but he's also the prophet who appoints the first king. So he's already anointed Saul, who's now being rejected by the Lord. And he's also already anointed David, who's the one who the Lord is going to bring and destined to be king. But now Samuel has died and Israel mourns for him. But the purposes of God go on. In some ways it seems quite strange, well, surprising maybe, that it's recorded in just one verse. It's this great man, this significant figure, and yet just one verse, the beginning verse 1 of chapter 25, records his death. So we're just told he died. We're told Israel gathered and mourned for him. He's buried in Ramah, his home. And then we're back again to David. And we might think, why so little space? Well, we're not told for sure. But it is a reminder to us that actually God's purposes aren't bound up in a person. They're bigger than that. They go on. And God's purposes carry on. We come and we go. We have our moment and we die. But God's purposes go on. I say... God's purposes aren't bound up in one person, but of course they are bound up in one person. That person, but only in one person. That one person is Jesus Christ and him alone. And all the rest of us, we come and we go, and we're in God's purposes, and then we die. And so that happens to Samuel. He comes, here he is, he's had his day, he's served the Lord, now he dies, and he enters glory, and the work goes on. And the same will happen to us, because God's purposes are bigger than us all. And unless Jesus returns first, there'll be a day when we die. And the key thing is, are we ready for that? Because in this book, in this chapter, there's one person who definitely isn't ready and suddenly is ushered into eternity. And we need to be wise and ready. But our day will come, won't it? We, as I said on men's breakfast yesterday morning, we were looking at the big early history of the life of this church. All those names, people who stood in this pulpit and then no more. We only remember their names when we flick through the book. And we don't know very much about them. And the same will be true of me and everyone who stands in this pulpit as the days go by. But Jesus Christ rules and reigns, and we rejoice in him. So, how to be wise, how to spot a fool, that's what we're going to look at. In this intriguing chapter, it's sandwiched in between two chapters that tell us of occasions when David spares Saul. So we consider the first of these last time. It was about 3 weeks ago now when Saul comes into that cave where David and his men are hiding, and David could have killed Saul. He could have exacted his revenge, and we sort of wait for him to do that, but he doesn't. And in the next chapter, chapter 26, we'll have another occasion when David could. He stood over Saul in the night as he's asleep. He could have killed him, but he doesn't. And yet sandwiched between those two chapters, we have this fascinating chapter. And the way I want to look at it tonight, you'll see from the sheet, is by considering the main characters and seeing what we're meant to learn from them. So we've got a foolish man, Nabal, an inconsistent man, David, a wise woman, Abigail, and a gracious God, the Lord. So let's just spend a little bit of time thinking about each of these. So first of all, a foolish man, Nabal. Sometimes you hear the name that parents give their children, don't you? And And you wonder, whatever were they thinking of when they gave them that name? And, you know, did they think of what that would mean for that poor child? You know, we've named him Zeus, or, you know, people do all sorts of names, don't they, now? And you think, really? Are you sure about that? Well, I wonder whether the people of Maon had that sort of thought when Nabal's parents came out and said, we've called him Nabal. Perhaps they just had a feeling about their son. Anyway, his name means fool or foolish. And sadly, Nabal lived up to his name. Hugh means intelligent. Sadly, not everybody lives up to their names. But this is Nabal, fool. And that's what we're going to find. Look at verse 25. His own wife says of him, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. His parents either had a strange sense of humor or they just they knew something. Well, we ought to note as we begin to think about him that though we don't know anything about his parents, we know he came from a godly line. Look at verse 3. He comes from the house of Caleb. You young people, you children remember Caleb? He was the faithful one, wasn't he, along with Joshua. The two spies who, when they went into the land, came back and said, yes, God is great. We can take this. We can trust God. And Caleb was a wise man, a faithful man. And yet here, from his line, comes a foolish man. It's a reminder, isn't it, that fools can come from good stock. So, young people here tonight, remember, you not just because you have Christian parents and grandparents, doesn't mean you necessarily won't be a fool, won't be a Nabal. It's possible, isn't it? There's plenty of them. So we've got to learn from Nabal and the warning of his life. It's important for us to consider, what sort of a fool was he? What made him a fool? Because you see, he wouldn't be considered a fool by the world and its standards, would he? Not at all. He'd have been considered a man to be looked up to, a man to be envied and admired, and a man to model yourself on. Look what we're told about him in the opening verses. Well, verse 2, look, he's a businessman. He has a business in Carmel. He's a landowner. He's a cattle owner. He's a farmer. We're told in verse 2, he was very rich. He owns, this puts some sheep owning into perspective, doesn't it? He owned 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. And he's a man of power. He's a man of influence. He's got a number of servants who work for him. It's clear he's a big man in the area. And we're also told in verse 3, look, he's got a beautiful, intelligent wife. Somehow he's succeeded in landing a catch, hasn't he? That's no doubt left many men in the area looking on enviously. Imagine he's got a number of suitors vying for this lady, but he has got her. So he's rich and successful, he's got a beautiful, intelligent wife, and he knows how to party as well, doesn't he? He knows how to have a good time. We get down to verse 36, we're told he's holding a feast in his house that's fit for a king, it says, doesn't it, in verse 36. Holding a the feast of a king, the food is sumptuous, it's the best food, the wine is flowing, and on the occasion in question, Nabal has got merry. Indeed, he's got very drunk. Indeed, eat, drink, and be merry was his philosophy for life. It reminds us, doesn't it, of that rich farmer in the parable in Luke chapter 12. So successful, he hasn't got enough room to store all his crops and all his goods. Going to take it easy, take an early retirement, eat, drink, and be merry. That's Nabal. It's not the world's idea of a fool, is it? A rich, successful businessman with a beautiful wife who knows how to have a good time and have a party. Well, that's what everyone wants, isn't it? That's what everyone wants to be like. That's the world. This is a man who knows how to live and what life's all about. But as far as the Bible's concerned, Nabal is living up to his name. He's a fool. Now, what is a fool as far as the Bible's concerned? Well, a fool is a person, first of all, we could say, who says in his heart there's no God. That's Psalm 14, verse 1. The fool has said in his heart there is no God. Now, I think it's significant that it says in his heart there's no God. Because somebody can have an outward show. Someone could turn up to church every Sunday, in fact, and yet in their heart be saying, and living as if there was no God, as if there's no judgment, as if you can live as you please and do what you want and you're God of your own life. I mean, that's what it is to live in your heart and say in your heart there is no God. So you can say outwardly there's a God, and yet in your heart say there is no God and live as if there was no God. That was Nabal, wasn't it? Through and through. He's just like the man in Luke 12. It makes me wonder sometimes whether the Lord has Nabal in mind when he gives this parable. You know, living for the moment, for fun, ignoring God, thinking that all he has was his own. You remember in the parable it says, you know, how I've got my goods, my crops, I'll say to myself. Well, that's exactly, look at verse 11 here. In our passage, 1 Samuel 25, verse 11. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers? Wow, it's just like that man in the parable that Jesus tells. You know, I've done this. I've made this. I've got myself where I am. These are my things. So a fool is somebody who lives as if there wasn't a God. But a fool is also someone who continues to do evil. So Proverbs 13, verse 90, it is an abomination to fools to depart from evil. It's an abomination for fools to depart from evil. They don't want to depart. They want to be. So a fool isn't just somebody who's a bit thick in the head. I mean, that's quite a few of us, isn't it? But a fool is somebody who loves evil and goes after evil. Can you turn with me to Isaiah 32, Isaiah 32 and verse 6. Here's a definition of a fool. The foolish person, Isaiah 32, 6. For the foolish person will speak foolishness, and his heart will work iniquity, to practice ungodliness, to utter error against the Lord, to keep the hungry unsatisfied, and he will cause the drink of the thirsty to fail. Wow, that's quite a description of a foolish person, isn't it? His heart will work iniquity. He'll practice ungodliness. He'll utter error. He'll be godless and keep the hungry unsatisfied, selfish. Well, that's Nabal, wasn't it? That was what he was like. Verse 3, back in our passage, he was harsh and evil in his doing. He was a man who was characterized by selfishness and greed, and that comes out when his servants come to him. David's servants come and graciously ask for some food for David and his men. David and his men have obviously treated Nabal's men kindly. They protected them while they've been out in the wilds, looked after them. But when they come and ask humbly for some food, well, we saw, didn't we, how Nabal responds in verse 10. Who is David and who is this son of Jesse? Oh, there are many servants nowadays who break away. Why should I take my stuff and give it to them? A foolish, Proverbs 18:7 says, a fool's mouth is his destruction and his lips are the snare of his soul. That was certainly true of Nabal. And his foolishness also means that he can't be reasoned with. Can you not be reasoned with? Well, that's just, you know, that's just something you've got to be careful about, that, because that's a sign of a fool. Look at verse 17. The servant says to Abigail, he is such a scoundrel that no one can speak to him. I mean, the servant clearly speaks from much experience of perhaps trying to tell his master something or reason with him, but he knows his master won't listen. He's too foolish, pig-headed to admit when he's wrong, and he's just going to go on. His way is always the right way. Any of us like that? Well, we need to heed this warning, don't we? He knows best, and he'll do his own thing, and he won't listen. He's gone on a course. I'm just going to do it anyway. I'm not going to listen to anyone else. That's a foolish man. That's a description of a foolish man. Living for the day, knowing what's best, living as if there's no God, no judgment, no heaven, no hell. Living as if there was no death. Of course, it's not the only way that we've seen already that this is alike the parable in Luke chapter 12, because what happens in Luke chapter 12? Well, we know, don't we? The man in the parable thinks he's got many years ahead. Sit back, eat, drink, and be merry. Take your ease. And how does Jesus have it in that parable? You fool. This night your soul will be required of you. Then who will those things be which you have provided? That's exactly what happens to Nabal, isn't it? He's been drinking, he's been having this wonderful feast, his wife comes back, she knows there's no point talking to him while he's drunk. She waits till the morning, she tells him what's happened, and he's struck down, isn't he? Verse 37, his heart died within him, became like stone. I mean, I don't know what the medical reasoning for that was, but something happens to him, doesn't he? And 10 days later, before 10 days are over, he is dead and in the grave. Suddenly everything he has is taken from him. That's a fool, isn't it? Living rich in terms of this world, but not rich towards God. So that's a warning to us all this evening. How to spot a fool? What does a fool look like? Living as if there was no God. Living as if they were gods. Refusing to listen. Refusing to turn. Carrying on in sin. You could come to church every Sunday and that still be true of you. It's like the foolish man, isn't it? Building on a sand that can be swept away in a moment instead of building on Jesus the rock. So we've got a foolish man, Nabal. And then we've got an inconsistent man, David. It's striking that, as we've said, this comes between these two chapters in which David is so restrained. We saw, didn't we, in that last chapter, the amazing way in which, in spite of all that Saul's done to David, in spite of the way Saul has treated him, the way in which Saul is out to kill him, when David has his opportunity, he spares Saul's life. He's there in the cave, and his men are trying, go on, do it, and he leaves it in the Lord's hands. We used him last time as an example of how to treat your enemies. How to overcome evil with good. When we looked at David, we admired David for that. We said, this is a good example to follow. Look at him, leaving it with the Lord, leaving revenge with the Lord. Refusing to be pushed himself, not letting his men kill him. And yet here in this chapter, he reacts in completely the opposite way. Now, Nabal undoubtedly treats him badly. He's been looking for some kindness from Nabal, some generosity, as we say, especially in the light of the fact that David's cared for him and his men have helped him and protected his sheep. And yet instead of returning kindness with kindness, Nabal has spoken as he has in insulting manner. And how does David respond? Well, he determines he's going to kill him and all his men. Come on, he says. 400 of you, that'll do. 200 stay with the supplies. 400 of you, get your swords. I'm getting my sword. Let's go. And we find that verse 22, his plan is to kill all the males before the morning. Wow, we go, that is incredible. The man who'd been so measured and so ready to leave things with the Lord in the last chapter is now buckling his sword and taking things into his own hands and wanting his pound of flesh. Having been ready last time to overcome evil with good, now he wants to return evil with more evil. And had the Lord not stopped him, that is what he would have done. He would have killed Nabal and his men. He says it himself. And he'd have had blood on his hands, and that would have been hanging over him for the rest of his days. And I just want us to see, that is just a reminder of how inconsistent we can all be. Even the best of men, we can see the right thing to do on one occasion, we can do the right thing on one occasion, we can have great restraint on one occasion, and on another time we can completely fail. And it's a reminder to us of what we could all do if the Lord didn't stop us. Come back to this in a moment, but it's a sobering to consider that what we could do at times, if the Lord didn't send someone to warn us through his word, through some providence. I mean, we're fickle people, and our hearts can be so changeable, and one time we can do the right thing, and if we're not careful, the next time we're faced with the same sort of situation, we can do the wrong thing. And we need to be careful. Him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. Often the most dangerous time is just after we've done the right thing. Just after some victory. Because then the tendency is to think we've got it sorted. And we can do it in our own strength. Let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall, the Bible says. We see that with Peter, don't we, on the night of Jesus dies. I mean, he's very brave, isn't he, when he goes, gets his sword out to cuts off the high priest's servant's ear. But then very shortly after that, he's denying he knows the Lord to a servant girl. So, it's just a warning to us, isn't it? And we're thankful the Bible's honest. It's interesting, it's tucked here between these two accounts of David being very restrained. Ah, but here's a picture that, yeah, just that Nabal. I mean, we can all, we can appreciate it, can't we? I mean, he's an horrible guy, and we could all wish him out of the way, and of course he gets does get put out of the way, but it's not how to act, is it? David's inconsistency. We could also speak of his inconsistency in taking himself two wives at the end of the chapter. I mean, we know that there were others too. It was commonplace at the time. Other godly men did it, but it clearly not the pattern set down at the beginning. And time again brought trouble. You abandon God's pattern and go against his words, and trouble will come. And that we'll see that sadly in the life of David as well, as sons from different children battle and fight for supremacy in David's family. The best of men are men at best. Let's use this to humble ourselves. Let's use this to go, Lord, I'm not strong in myself. I can be inconsistent. I need your grace. Help me not to be a fool. Help me to be wise. Okay, so we've got a foolish man, Nabal, an inconsistent man, David, a wise woman, Abigail. What an odd match Abigail and Nabal were. You do get that sometimes, don't you? You see a couple. I'm going to look at the clock here because I'm not going to make out I'm thinking of anybody here. I'm not thinking of anybody here. But sometimes you look up and you go, however did those two get together? Well, however, whatever did she see in him? Or however it might be. When, I mean, he's a foolish, hard-hearted, mean man. She's intelligent, wise, gracious, and most important of all, godly. I mean, it probably was an arranged marriage, wasn't it? I imagine that might have been the case, but here's this wise woman. Let's consider how she acts. So she comes into the story. I mean, she's described earlier on, but she comes into the story in verse 14, doesn't she? When one of Nabal's servants comes to warn her what her husband has done and tell her that he felt they were in trouble. I do get wonder whether this has happened many times before, that she's had to sort these sort of things out. But what do we see here? Well, we see that she acts quickly and she speaks wisely. So she acts quickly, doesn't she? I mean, David and his men are on their way. She's got to act quickly. And if she fails to act quickly, all the males in the household are going to be dead. She realizes what's going to happen. There's no time to lose. And so in verse 18, look, she hurriedly puts together this large amount of food. I mean, it does show, doesn't it, that when Nabal refuses David and his men food, I mean, he's got plenty of food. It's not that he's hard up for food. I mean, there's 200 loaves of bread, 2 skins of wine, 5 sheep already dressed. By the way, children, in case you're wondering what we've got sheep dressed up, that means all ready, prepared to eat, you know, cooked and ready, not dressed in clothes. 5 seers of roasted grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, and loaded them on donkeys. So she's going to speak to David, but she's wise enough to know that words might not be enough, and she probably knows that, well, you know, a good way to deal with make a man happy is to give him some good food to eat. And so she knows that's wisdom, isn't it? She acts wisely. She acts quickly. She acts wisely. She brings along, this is what he was asking for in the first place. She seems to know what to do, how to deal with the situation. To act quickly, sometimes that's needed, isn't it? I mean, sometimes you can act too quickly, but sometimes we don't act quickly enough. And she goes out to intercept David, and she meets him, and she falls on her face before him, doesn't she, in verse 23. So she acts quickly, and she speaks wisely. There's real wisdom in how she speaks in this passage of David. I'm not going to read it all again, but you've got from verse 24 down to verse 31, this long passage of she speaks, and I want to point out 2 things about how she speaks. You see them there on the sheet. She speaks graciously. So she's faced with a very angry man. David is a very angry man. He's going to kill every male in her household. She speaks very graciously to David. She bows before him. She calls him my lord, doesn't she, in verse 24. She takes this on herself. She acknowledges the folly and the wickedness of her husband in verse 25, doesn't she? She acknowledges the righteousness of David in verse 28. He fights the battles of the Lord. She gently reminds David of the possible consequences of shedding innocent blood. She speaks very graciously and gently. But a soft answer turns away wrath, the proverb says, doesn't it? And certainly does that here. She's humble. She bows. She speaks graciously to David. She speaks graciously, but she also speaks theologically. Okay, so not only is her speech gracious, it's theological. By that I mean she brings the Lord into it. Look at these verses. Look how many times she mentions the Lord in her words. I mean, I haven't counted it up, but there's a number of times where verse 26, now therefore, my Lord, as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, since the Lord has held you back from coming to bloodshed. Then verse 28, Lord, she says, please forgive the trespass of your maidservant, for the Lord will certainly make for my Lord an enduring house, because my Lord fights the battles of the Lord, and evil is not found in you throughout your days. Got it there in verse 29. Yet a man has arisen to pursue you and seek your life, but the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living with the Lord your God. Verse 30. It shall come to pass when the Lord has done for my Lord all that, according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you ruler over Israel, it will mean no grief to you, nor offense of heart to my Lord, either that you have shed blood without cause, or that my Lord avenged himself. But when the Lord has dealt well with my Lord, then remember my son. Do you see how he's bringing the Lord in? What's she doing? David, in his rage, has sort of almost forgotten the Lord, hasn't he? And she comes and she just reminds him as she speaks to him of the Lord, of the fact that David's the Lord's servant, and the Lord will avenge, and the Lord's got David in his hand. And normally, David, you're doing the Lord's battles, fighting the Lord's battles, and rather than, as you are at the moment, fighting your own. And they're wonderful words that turn David's thoughts from those of foolish revenge to the Lord's purposes and to the Lord again. And David has to acknowledge, doesn't he? Look, verse 32 and 33, that the Lord, she's been sent by the Lord. David said to Abigail, blessed is the Lord God of Israel who sent you this day to meet me. And blessed is your advice and blessed are you because you've kept me this day from coming to bloodshed and from avenging myself with my own hand. So that's how she speaks. She speaks graciously and she speaks theologically. And that's a good example for us. We all need counsel at times. We all need advice. We all at times set out to do foolish things and on foolish paths. What do we need? We need advice. We need people to come to us. We need one another to speak to us. And how am I going to need you to speak to me when I made a foolish decision or I've gone on a foolish path? Well, I'm going to need you to speak to me graciously and gently, but also theologically. You're going to need to remind me of the Lord and his purposes and bring the Lord into it. That's what we're going to need, aren't we, from one another. There's going to be times when you need advice. There's going to be times when you've got to give advice. And we can learn, I think, from the wisdom of this woman, Abigail. She's a wise woman. She acts wisely and she speaks wisely. And there's a great difference, isn't there, between Nabal and David at this point. Because while Nabal won't listen to anyone's advice, and people will actually give up trying to advise him, David was ready, at least, wasn't he, to listen. I mean, he's acted inconsistently, but it doesn't take that much to bring him to his senses, does it? And he's ready to acknowledge when he's wrong, and it's a timely word from the Lord. What a wise woman. We need to pray for wisdom. We need to remember that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. If you're going to be wise, you need to spend time with wise people, with a wise person, and the wisest person is the Lord. I need to spend time in his words and time with him. And we've read, haven't we, and sung, this word is able to make the simple wise. Okay, let's think lastly as we finish. We've had a foolish man, an inconsistent man, a wise woman, and now a gracious God, the Lord. Now, this passage just reminds us, don't mess with God. I mean, we mustn't miss that, must we? I mean, you mustn't play with the living God. Nabal does and discovers that to his peril. He is a God who of righteousness and holiness and justice, and the unrepentant will be condemned in the end. And God deals very solemnly with Nabal so that we can't sort of just go, oh, well, it wakes us up, doesn't it? It should do. But we do see the graciousness of the Lord in holding David back from sin. I mean, this would have been a serious blot, wouldn't it? Early on. In his life, in his ability to be the king, if he'd have done this, if he'd taken this into his own hands. And God is very gracious to David in his folly, that he actually sends Abigail and stops him in his tracks. And I think to myself, how often has the Lord done that for me? I mean, he's gracious enough to bear with us in our folly, isn't he? And stop us from ending up where our follies would take us, very often by wise advice of godly Christians, or through his word, or through providences where he just stops us from being able to be the fools that we would otherwise be. And we see a loving, gracious Father in that, who watches over us. And Jesus taught us to pray, didn't he? Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from the evil one. Lord, help me, keep me, guard me from my own foolish heart. And of course, there's an ultimate way in which the Lord has intervened, as it were, to stop us facing the full consequences of our sin. And that's at the cross, isn't it? By coming into the world and taking our sin and dying in our place so that we don't have to bear it. Because the truth of the matter is that neither me or you have always stopped or been stopped from sin. Sometimes God's put barriers in our way and we've just run over them anyway and done our own thing and gone our own way. And so how thankful we are that there is a way of mercy and a way of forgiveness. Because the truth of the matter is that we could have all have been given the name Nabal, really. I mean, every one of us, I hope you don't mind me saying this, but it's true. Every one of us is a Nabal. And it's been a Nabal. We've been fools in our own lives. We've gone after sin. I mean, there's nothing more foolish than going after sin. There's nothing more foolish than drinking from the dirty puddle rather than from the fountain of living water. And so every one of us need a savior, a rescuer. Every one of us needs the Lord Jesus Christ. And so we need to cast ourselves afresh on him tonight. So let's learn from this chapter how to spot a fool, how to be wise. Lord, keep me from foolish ways. Help me to be truly wise. Help us to live as if you are God and you alone.